Well, some years ago, I found Poisson brackets for a set of free null initial data. But the aim of that project is really to quantize that. And so I'm going to talk today about how to use tools from integrable systems to make make a change of variables to make the initial data quantizable. Let's say, give an idea of how to quantize the initial data. Okay. So this is joint work with my student, Andreas Fuchs. Plan of the talk, this is the plan of the talk. I have to apologize to the people who have already seen a number of my talks on this subject. The first half or so of the talk, I'll be reviewing the canonical framework for general relativity on null hypersurfaces that I'm using. And Laurent is already leaving because maybe he'll come back halfway through the talk. Okay, so then I will talk about the Poisson brackets with the main data. That's still the review part. And I will relate that to Poisson brackets in cylindrically symmetrical gravity. In fact, what I will show you is that that the Poisson brackets in cylindrically symmetrical gravity capture essentially all of the algebraic complexity of the general symmetryless case. Okay? And then I'll present the transformation to new data, give you the Poisson brackets of the new data, and then I'll talk about the quantization of this new Poisson algebra. Okay? Okay, so here is start by explaining what the geometrical setup. So I have two null hypersurfaces, or they could be called light fronts. That's what light front quantization people call it. We have two of these null hypersurfaces that meet on a space-like two disk S0. Here's a picture of the situation in 2+1 dimensions. There, the null surfaces are two-dimensional, and the intersection is a line. But of course, we're in, I'm going to talk really about 3+1 dimensions. And here's a picture of this initial data hypersurface in 3+1 dimensions. Because it's difficult to draw things in an intelligible way for 3+1, I've drawn it here without embedding it in space-time. Okay, so the two null hypersurfaces are solid cylinders that are swept out by null geodesics emerging normally in space-time from this two-dimensional disk, okay, from the two sides of this two-dimensional disk. Okay, so initial data on such a pair of null hypersurfaces determine the solution to the vacuum Einstein equations in a compact four-dimensional space-time region called the domain of dependence. Oh, I should say that here I don't follow these null geodesics. I don't let them extend infinitely because they form caustics, which complicate enormously the formalism. So they're cut off. All these null geodesics that sweep out these null hypersurfaces are cut off before they form any caustics. Okay. Okay. So I want to present to you now some free initial data. That's initial data which is in a one-to-one correspondence with the solutions because there are no constraints. So every valuation of this data, to every valuation, there corresponds a solution. And of course, for every solution, there's a set of data. And they determine the data uniquely. So, okay. But to present these data, I need to show you a little. They refer to a coordinate system, okay? So adapted to this initial data surface. So the coordinate system is built up in the following way. I define coordinates on the intersection two surface between the two null hypersurfaces. Here I've drawn only one of the null hypersurfaces, and here's the intersection two surface. And I hold these constant on the generators, the null geodesics that sweep out the null hypersurfaces. Okay? Then that gives me two coordinates. I need three. The third coordinate is a parameter along each of these generators. And it's just chosen so that the cross-sectional area of a bundle of these generators goes as the parameter V squared. So it's the cross-sectional area at some point here, V, is equal to the cross-sectional area here at the initial two surface times V squared. Okay, so what are the data? There are two types of data, what I call bulk data, which are defined on, are given on the entire null, in each of the null hypersurfaces.
Just a question about the, so you assume that it's always expanding?
No. Sorry. No, I cut them off before they form caustics. In fact, the more interesting case is where they're always contracting.
Go up and down.
That's an unfortunate thing.
You say the area is new square, the area increases, you increase new.
It's V. It's just this beamer has this bad habit of rendering as new. But it's it can decrease. V is 1 here, okay? And if it's contracting, it just drops down and would drop to 0 at a caustic, but you cut off.
It starts to get.
Yes, you always assume it's monatomic.
That's what we're after.
If it's initially expanding, I would have to cut it off not only before it forms a caustic, but before it starts to recontract. Okay. I'm more interested actually in the case where it's contracting from the beginning. But
these surfaces contract.
Right. So you always, it always eventually it will start to focus, or at best it can just continue. It can never contract and then start expanding again. Yeah. In vacuum gravity. So it's not even any positive energy. We're just assuming vacuum generativity.
Okay, and because you're interested in initial data, there's just one of these sets of, one of these pairs of surfaces.
No, there are two, and even
both really to be initial data.
You could imagine a family of them filling up the space time.
But this is all about initial data, so we're just always on the same on the same surface. Yeah, you can imagine an evolution scheme based on
one. It would be one parameter family of these.
Sure.
Okay.
Okay, so there are two types of data. There's the bulk data, which is defined on the entire pair of
null hypersurfaces. And that's what we're going to concentrate on in this talk. Actually, there's only, in a sense, one, the bulk datum, and that's the what I call the conformal 2 metric on these null hypersurfaces. So I have to explain a little bit. These null hypersurfaces, well, being null, they're degenerate. And the tangents to the generators are null vectors, and they're orthogonal to the surface. Therefore, if you look at the induced line element on the hypersurface, it has no, if you express it in terms of these coordinates, where theta 1 and theta 2 are constant along the generators and therefore along the tangents, and only V measures the measures displacements along the generators, then you have no dV terms in the line element, okay? Because those the partial derivative along V is a null vector that's orthogonal to everything in the surface. Okay, so that means that the induced metric, which is a priori a degenerate 3-metric really is equivalent to just a Riemannian 2-metric, okay, which is you can think of as the 2-metric of cross sections that cut these generators transversely. Okay? So that gives you a 2-metric, and you can divide this now by the square root of its determinant, and then you get an object that that depends only on the conformal structure. It's invariant under Weyl transformations. And so this is the conformal 2-metric. It's an object, it's a 2x2 matrix of determinant 1. And of course, it's symmetric, so it has only 2 real degrees of freedom, which you could parameterize by 1 complex degree of freedom at each point, right? And one way to do this, one very nice way, is the following. Here's the line element again, written in terms of this scalar mu and this complex conjugate, mu bar. It's just a generalization of the old trick for expressing the Euclidean plane metric in terms as d by dz. Here, z is the theta 1 plus I theta 2. Okay, so it's a complex coordinate replacing the thetas. And because it's an arbitrary metric, I have to take into account the possibility that there's not only a dz by dz bar term, but also a dz bar by dz bar and a dz by dz. And then taking into account that it's real, I get that the coefficient of dz by dz is the complex conjugate of the coefficient of dz bar by dz bar. And then if I want to isolate the determinant of h, then I have to pull out a factor 1 minus mu over mu bar. And so then I finally get this expression. And as you see, E is obtained by taking the metric and dividing by rho, the determinant of h. So E, in fact, depends only on mu and, well, mu bar, which is the complex conjugate. I can also do this for a complex metric. And then mu and mu bar are simply independent variables. Okay. In addition, so that's the bulk data that's specified on the whole null surfaces. In addition, there's data that's just given on the intersection of the two surfaces, on this two surface S0, which are rho 0, the area density on this two surface, and the two other data which we really won't talk about, so I won't explain them. Okay. So one can work out the Poisson brackets for these data, and I did that a few years ago, and here they are. Okay. There are some more, that all the other ones are zero. So you can say how terrible, but you can also say how nice, because you can write them all in one page. So they're sort of in a mid-level of nice, between nice and terrible. They're not intractable. You can write them. But on the other hand, it's far from obvious how you go about quantizing. Okay? Now, we're going to concentrate on just the brackets of the mu's, which are somehow, I call them the main data, to call them something. Okay? Those are the bulk data. All the other data just live on the two surface. Okay, so here are the brackets of the mu's, including the zero brackets. What does this say? This says that the mu, which is this encoding of the conformal metric, mu at one point, which I call 1, Poisson bracket with mu at another point, which I call 2, is 0 for any pair of points on the initial data hypersurface. And the same for the mu bars. Poisson commutes with itself at any other point. The only bracket that can be non-zero is between mu and mu bar. So here's the expression for that bracket. There's a delta function here, which imposes the condition that the points 1 and, well, which means that the bracket is non-zero only if 1 and 2 lie on the same generator. Okay? And then there's a step function here that says it's non-zero only if, well, it's 1, the step function is 1, if the point 2 follows the point 1 going out from S0 along the generator, and it's 0 otherwise. Okay? And then there's some more stuff here, which the most notable is that you have an exponential here, which is a phase when mu and mu bar are complex conjugates, which depends on mu on the whole line between 1 and 2. Okay. So the fact that only data on the same generator have a non-zero bracket is actually quite natural. It's because only points on the same generator are causally connected. Okay, they're connected, obviously, by a null geodesic a light ray. All other points on N are space-like separated. There's no causal curve connecting them. Okay, and a curious feature of this bracket, if you play around with it a bit, is that it doesn't quite preserve the reality of the induced metric on this null hypersurface. So that's very alarming at first sight, because what I mean by that is I can take a real function of mu and mu bar, use it as a Hamiltonian to act on the metric with this bracket, and it will produce a metric which has some imaginary component. It turns out that this is not as terrible as it seems, because this imaginary mode does not propagate into the domain of dependence. It's a shock wave that just goes along the surface of these null hypersurfaces.
What do you mean it doesn't preserve reality?
It doesn't affect you add them to the initial data and they don't.
Can you explain why it doesn't preserve reality? Because you have this phase?
Basically, when you take the complex conjugate in the obvious way of this of this bracket, you don't get the same bracket back. You don't get my. You would expect that if you take the complex conjugate, you get the bracket of mu bar at 1 with mu at 2, and you don't. You get something with an extra bit, right? Which means that the bracket itself is not real.
But does that mean that? Isn't that a problem, or is it because you use this mu variable and then the metric is real, or because the bracket for the metric is real?
No.
I would say no. There is. I get back to it, but I can say again what I found is that though there is this uncomfortable thing, it doesn't affect the metric in the domain of dependence. That is, you change the initial data, but it doesn't change the metric. It just produces a shock wave that travels along the surface and doesn't enter the interior of the domain of dependence. So the metric in the interior domain of dependence remains real.
Is it due to the fact that you use an epsilon function and not an epsilon function?
Yeah.
So why don't you use an epsilon function?
Because then I don't have the Jacobi relations. I don't have the Jacobi relations fail then.
Where does it fail? Everywhere?
So you have to give up something, associativity or reality. Which one is more serious?
Right. So I thought it was more serious to give up associativity because I know less about non-associative algebras than I know about complex numbers.
Right. It's just a choice. You could go for a give up the Jacobi relation and keep going. But actually,
you can do that if you take a time-like slice. So why? No. Can you explain why is that happening?
No, I don't know.
But it's a problem that disappears further on. So,
because I do
a change of variables, and the new variables will be insensitive to precisely this complex, this imaginary mode.
But I don't know on a, aside from the fact that this works, I don't know how to,
I don't have a, let's say, I don't have what a way of thinking about it that makes the answer obvious.
You're saying you have a word formulation now where you don't have this problem.
Right. Okay. That's where we're going, so. Okay.
So this bracket, you know, it has its own elegance, it's very nice, but it's not very obvious how to quantize it. In particular, it's not just you have a bracket between a field and 2 points, and that involves the field at those 2 points. No, it involves the field at all the intermediate points. So it's far more complicated than canonical brackets. So let's try to solve a slightly simpler problem.
For instance, equal to a similar bracket for a scalar field, if you consider null initial data for a scalar field?
Yeah, it's similar. But there isn't the problem with the
Jacobi relations. You can put the, at least with a free scalar, it shouldn't make any difference. You can just put the sine function instead of the step function and the heavy side,
and it works. Then the Jacobi relation is preserved. So.
The problem is because of the step function.
Right. That's why reality isn't preserved.
Okay. So let's consider a simpler problem. Okay, let's just, drop the delta function and suppose that mu and mu bar, instead of being functions on three surfaces, are functions on a single line. So this is what I call the one generator algebra, because in some sense, if the delta, Dirac delta here were a Kronecker delta, then you could say, well, this Poisson algebra falls apart into a bunch of commuting one generator algebras, where this is one, and the data on each generator just has a non-trivial bracket with itself and a zero bracket with everything else. Okay, that of course is not really correct because this is a Dirac delta, not a Kronecker delta. But in any case, this, right, okay. So morally, somehow it's true. And it seems clear that if you can quantize this, then you've come a long way to quantizing the other guy. Okay, so this is what I call the one generator algebra. Now, fortunately, this one generator algebra turns out to be the Poisson algebra of a system, not just an invention. It is, in fact, the Poisson, the bracket of the mu's in cylindrically symmetric general relativity on a particular class of these double null hypersurfaces, which are swept out by light rays that go radially from the symmetry axis. So here I've made a drawing of such a null initial hypersurface. The symmetry axis, well, let's suppress the dimension along the symmetry axis. Okay, so this is cylindrically symmetrical gravity. So one symmetry is just translation along the symmetry axis. Nothing changes. So let's just suppress that to be able to draw a picture. Now we have the symmetry axis becomes a point in space, and it has a world line. So this is not the symmetry axis. This is the world line of the dimensionally reduced symmetry axis, if you like. Okay? But a point on this world line, of course, is the symmetry axis, and here are null geodesics that go radially outward from this symmetry axis, and you can form one of these double null hypersurfaces from these. And because of, well, the other symmetry is rotation about this point or about this world line. And of course, if you have this symmetry, then mu on each of these null geodesics is the same. It's the same function of the parameter along the null geodesics. So really, you have one function mu on a single line, which you can take to be any one of these generators, and you can ask what is the Poisson bracket between these, and you can get that Poisson bracket in two ways. At least you can take the cylindrically symmetric gravity as a subspace of the phase space of cylindrically symmetric gravity as a subspace of the full symmetryless phase space, and defined by certain constraints that impose cylindrical symmetry, and you can do a Dirac type reduction, take the Dirac bracket, and you end up with this. Or you can write a symmetry reduced action, and again, you get this. Okay. Okay. So this is very nice, because cylindrically symmetric gravity, or vacuum gravity, is an integrable system. Okay, you might remember that it has this big group of symmetries, the Gerosch group. And, well, it's an integrable system. And in fact, a quantization of this system has been found at the algebraic level. Okay, so there's an exact algebra of observables to all orders in H bar. Not too much is known about the vacuum or the state that so you haven't finished quantizing it quite, but you've gone a long way. You have the algebra.
It has also been considered by Ashtika and somebody else.
But they considered a simpler system where you have put a restriction on the polarization of the gravitational
polarization. But the Carr Hussein considered both polarizations before all these people, not rigorously.
I've seen the Carr's papers also. Well, many people have, but I think these
people, you know, finished the job at least at the algebraic level. Okay, so they did this quantization, but they didn't quantize mu and mu bar. They quantized some other variables, and so one thing to do is find a transformation from mu and mu bar to the variables that were quantized. Okay, so here goes. I'm going to tell you what this transformation is in detail. So I will do this transformation in steps. First, I will go from mu and mu bar to a sort of a Zweibein for the conformal two metric. Then I'll make a deformation of this Zweibein V and get a V hat, which depends on a parameter, which for us will be real, called the spectral parameter. And that finally defines, from V hat, we can define an object called a monodromy matrix, which will be a 2x2 matrix depending on this real parameter, the spectral parameter. And that will be the new data. Okay. So as I said, V is a Zweibein for the conformal two metric, that is E is equal to V times V transpose. Since mu and mu bar determine E.
Is this on a null surface now, or is this on the
two surface?
And just on the space?
Just on one point.
It's two surface, but
it's one point.
Sorry, what?
Just one point now.
It's just one point. Oh. This is on the space?
Where is this tri-binary?
Okay. So, yeah, you're right.
So let me back up a little bit. I want to, E is still the metric, the conformal two metric on the constant parameter orbits that cut these generators, right? So these now are identified with symmetry orbits of the cylindrical symmetry. Okay, so E is the conformal two metric on the symmetry orbits of the cylindrical symmetry.
And their function
is a function only of V, of the along any one of these generators. Always the same function.
We're in four dimensions though. We have it dimensionally reduced down.
We are, so I'm
in four dimensions, but now that the fields only, or the data only depend on one of the variables, and later when we talk a little bit about solutions, they will only depend on two of the coordinates, so we will also use symmetry reduced space-time. But E is not a metric on that space-time, but it's a metric on the space we factored out, which are the symmetry orbits. Okay. So now the this E will determine V modulo an SO2 worth of basis rotations. So one possible choice of V's is this one. It's upper diagonal determined by mu's. All the other ones are related to it by simply a basis rotation, you know, like what in four dimensions you call local Lorentz transformations, but here you're just in two dimensions and you can rotate the Zweibein in the internal space. Okay. So this is one possible Zweibein. Okay. I should say before I go on, a natural boundary condition for cylindrically symmetrical spacetimes is to require that the four metric be regular on the symmetry axis. Okay, that's natural for, I don't know if you want to think of it as some sort of a model, which is vacuum even on the axis, but we don't really care about that, and we will use another boundary condition, which we will impose that V is regular on the axis. And that's actually incompatible with this one. It implies that the four metric is not regular. But it doesn't matter. We just want a model that has these brackets. And it has the nice property that V is regular, because then we can construct things with V on the axis. Okay. And I'll say and one other thing. We're going to only treat the data on one of the branches here, on this branch that touches the asymmetry axis. Okay. So now we have this V, which is this Zweibein constructed out of mu or out of E. And now we're going to define this deformation depending on a parameter, V hat. So first, to do that, we define a one form on the symmetry reduced, well, really the symmetry reduced initial data surface, which is just a line, a one form on the generator, okay, which is V inverse dV. In the literature, it's often called a current, but really it has more the role of a connection. Okay? So, of course, you could reconstruct V by just taking V0 here and taking the path-ordered exponential of the integral of J from the axis to the point where you want V. Okay? But what we're going to do is we're going to change J a little bit and then reconstruct V, and we'll get a sort of a deformed V.
Okay, so I'll just give you the definitions. Okay, so this J, this
connection, has a symmetric and an antisymmetric part. So we decompose it into symmetric and antisymmetric part. we define now the deformed J, which has the same anti-symmetric part, but the symmetric part is multiplied by a factor that depends on this so-called spectral parameter. It's multiplied by W divided, the square root of W divided by W minus 2 times this, the area density, again, the area density on the symmetry orbits, which we factored out.
Rho is rho zero times v squared. It's the area density on the symmetry orbits.
What was W?
It's a parameter. It's called the spectral parameter. It has all of these things are charged with meaning in integrable system theory. But I'm just trying to extract what I actually use for this construction here. So I'm not explaining very much what they mean. It's just a parameter. Usually in integral systems theory, you use complex W and do a great deal with that. But here we just need it for an interval of real values. That's right.
2 by 2 matrix value 1/4.
J would be the spin connection solution of the. J would be the spin connection solution of the torsionless condition. I recognize the e to the minus one DE structure, but I'm not fixing
the
special
loop
to dimensions here.
I don't know.
It's kind of a trivially flat connection. It's just I don't know. I can't. Look. It's not the metric. This E lives on the symmetry orbits that we factored out. This lives on the quotient space. So
is the DGT also a flat connection?
The what?
Is the deal the fact that GT is still a flat connection?
That this is
that J hat is that's right. Well, I won't really use that, but in the inverse scattering method. You define this, in fact, you don't define it just on this line, you also define it, well, everywhere, and two components. And precisely, the condition that this is still a flat connection is equivalent to the condition that the fields obey the original nonlinear field equations. But that's OK, but I'm not using that. I've just defined this on this line. That's how you solve the is how you can construct in some sense a general solution to cylindrically symmetrical gravity with this so-called auxiliary linear problem. But okay. Let me just stick to the one thing I'm presenting. Okay. So we've now deformed J by multiplying its symmetric component by this extra factor. And now we're going to construct a deformed V by as V on the axis times the path-ordered exponential, but not of J, but of J hat. And we're going to integrate this. We're going to only evaluate this V hat at one point. Okay. We're going to integrate only up to the point where rho is equal to this spectral parameter divided by 2. Okay, goes to here. Okay, this gives us this deformed V at a special point. Of course, I could define this at all points, but for the construction, I only need it at one point. I don't think so. I'm not sure. But I did that earlier. I assumed that. That's true. But I don't know if I'm assuming it here. I don't think it's necessary. Ah, well, in that sense, yeah, OK. So let's just say rho is monotonic, because we already assumed that earlier on. So we're not losing anything by it. That's true. So it's equal to W over 2, so you have this point. Okay. So this, we're almost done with the definition of the transformation. So finally, you take this V hat, and you construct this deformed Zweibein, and you construct a sort of a deformed conformal 2 metric, which you call a monodromy matrix M. It's called that because it really is the monodromy matrix of a certain object. But that doesn't really matter right now. Okay, so you take V hat times V hat transpose, and that gives you this object, the monodromy matrix as a function of this spectral parameter, which you can also think of as a function on this initial data surface, because the value of the spectral parameter is associated with a point on the surface also. Okay, and in fact, it also has an interpretation as M, as an interpretation in terms of the solutions of the field equations, because it turns out that this M in W is equal to the undeformed, the original, conformal 2 metric at this point on the symmetry axis that's reached from this point here, where rho is W over 2, by a path-directed null geodesics. So it has a fairly direct interpretation, although it's some doing to show that this is actually true. It's a property of the solutions to the field equation. Okay, and you can also show that the transformation mu to mu bar is invertible modulo exactly this annoying imaginary shockwave mode. Okay, M is insensitive to this mode. So it has a straightforward reality condition. It's just that it's real. Okay, so as a sort of little side benefit, it's nicer than the original mu and mu bar in the sense that it doesn't have this unpleasant little imaginary mode.
You might think he wasn't well defined on the axis. Is that why you messed up on the boundary condition?
It is well defined because it's the conformal 2 metric. So
as you approach the axis, the metric on the symmetry orbits gets smaller and smaller, but it's divided by the area density, so.
Okay,
so now we have these new variables. What's the payoff? Well, the payoff is that when you do a lengthy calculation, you find that the Poisson brackets are these, okay, which are simpler and have certain crucial features that make them good for quantization. Okay, so let me explain what it is. So this is the Poisson bracket between M at spectral parameter V, or at the point rho is equal V over 2, and M at spectral parameter W. Here I use a notation that's common in integrable systems theory. That's you take, because you have a lot of matrices and a lot of indices flying around, you want to reduce that as much as possible. So you note that a tensor product of two matrices can be thought of as a matrices acting in the same space can be thought of as a linear map on the product of these on a product of two copies of this space. Okay. So you label upstairs with a number which space this particular matrix is acting in. So A acting in space 1 times B acting in space 2, that is the tensor product of A and B. So it's a four-index object, which is just, well, is here it is explicitly. I don't know if you've seen these before. It's well, it's nice when you get used to it. Okay, so here really we're giving the bracket between M with two indices and M with two other indices, okay, with no contraction between these indices. So the way we're expressing that is we're saying M in one space and MV in one space and M2 in the other space. Okay, so the bracket is in fact was 8 pi g divided by the difference in spectral parameter times this sum of products of m's at the two points. So it doesn't depend on anything at the two values of spectral parameter. It doesn't depend on any other, the value of m at any other spectral parameters except the two that you're dealing with here and taking the Poisson bracket for.
Martha? Yeah? Just a quick question. I'm just reading ahead. Since the point of the omega seems to be to subtract out the trace. Am I reading correctly?
Subtract off the trace, but I think the main point is.
It's. I don't know. It's this object. It's a four-index object.
But one way to describe it is that contracting omega on both indices in space 2, contracting it with, tracing it together with some matrix in space 2, will give you the same matrix in space 1.
Yeah, so let me just ask my question.
Sure.
If you took first the trace free parts of the two matrices, would the bracket be even simpler?
Let's see, because you're not actually.
If you don't know right away.
You're not tracing them together here.
It's just explaining that if you did that, just to give some sort of description of what this is other than this formula, you know, you're not actually, you're just multiplying these matrices.
So it's picking up
one index of this guy and one index of this guy. Well, this happens if you contract on both indices in space 2, you get something in space 1. But here you're not doing that. But
total trace on A, B, and C, D
would
still be non-zero.
You just bring us are computed so that the trace of M commutes, gives you the action variables. That's the deal about the monodromy. It's a decomposition of action and angular variables between diagonal and not diagonal.
I don't know. Okay.
So there are these omegas which are objects that act in tensors that act in both of the spaces and the product of the two spaces, the four index object. And well, that's.
So what does it mean when you multiply omega? It means contract on CD?
It means.
When you multiply on the top line, when you say omega.
It means you. So this has four indices. Two of them belong to space one, and two belong to space two. That's what the little comma
means. So the second set.
So here I'm just multiplying the last index in space one with, or contracting it with the first index of m in space one, and the last index in space two with the first index of m in space two.
So that's contracting on C and D in that lower.
On B and D.
On B and D. The second one is.
These are all the first space indices, and here are all the second space indices. Okay.
So, now, this algebra has a quantization, which was given by Korotkin and Samtlev, and I'm just going to show you what it is, just not to talk in the air, but I don't know if it will be very illuminating, but at least you see what I mean when I say it has a quantization. So there are quantum operators for the m's, and the algebra of these operators is a star algebra with M being real under star operation. M is symmetric, and it has this exchange relation, okay, which lets you, these R's are sort of cousins of the omegas. There are other four index objects that live in, acting in the two spaces. They're, well, basically R matrices that, come up a lot in integral systems theory. And here they are, okay? And this tells you how to, you know, if you have a product in one order, how to evaluate the product in the opposite order. So, which is basically what a commutator does. One could reorganize this into an expression commutator of M1 with M2 is equal to stuff. Okay, and finally, there's a condition that enforces, well, it's the quantization of the condition that M have determinant 1, which it does classically. It came from, well, monodromal matrix had determinant 1 the way I constructed it. Okay, so this was constructed at the, this was found at the algebraic level. It's it's the representations, the unitary representations of this algebra is not very well explored. So it sort of got stuck at the algebraic level. But all the same, there is a quantization of that. It's closely related to an object called an SL2 Yangian double, but it's a little bit different from the ones that have been treated more extensively in the literature. Okay. Yeah.
Is there a simple way to see how these get back to the classical algebra?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's simple.
No, it's fairly straightforward. I mean, if you set A to 0, no, A is 8 pi times the Planck area. Set A to 0, you end up with M, you know, the M1 times M2 is equal to M2 times M1. But, okay, so that's just saying that classically, the tensor product commutes. Then if you take the first order term in A, then you get the classical Poisson brackets. And then of course then there's more stuff at higher order. Okay, so I should say I'm not completely sure that this is the correct quantization of the matrix at a determinant equal one condition, because what Korotkin and Samtleben did actually is they quantized another algebra made of objects defined at spatial infinity, where they assumed there was spatial infinity. They quantized that. And then they showed that these objects, they expressed M in terms of these objects, showed that those M's classically had the Poisson brackets that I showed you, and also that in the quantum theory they obeyed these exchange relations. But they left the statement of the determinant one condition as a condition on these other objects. So I think I got the right statement for in terms of the M's, but that I'm a little bit less sure of than the rest.
But usually there's an easy check. You know, the quantum determinant, what you have to check is that it's commutes with any element of M.
Sure.
And then there's only one way to put it together.
Well, I
don't think it's particularly difficult, but I haven't really. This isn't why I haven't, you know. I'm showing you this basically because, I mean, what we did was basically the previous classical stuff. There I'm just showing you what Korotkin and Samtleben got from that algebra. Okay, so what remains, or some things that remain to be done, is the study representations of this M algebra. It would probably be illuminating to, well, in general, and to do it in the case of that Ashtekar and Pieri studied, which was quantized by Kukash in 71, where you have, instead of arbitrary polarizations, you only consider cylindrically symmetrical gravitational waves with polarization parallel to the symmetry axis. So that's understood more thoroughly than the general case, and you could see study representations of that. I think that's probably pretty hard going because Korotkin and Santleben got stuck there in 98, and it's been there ever since, more or less. Another problem, something to do, is we've ignored basically the data lambda and rho zero, which are data that live on the intersection two surface of the two null hypersurfaces. But they're present in the cylindrically symmetrical case. So they should be incorporated into this quantization. So that is something I'm doing now. And I think it's a very interesting problem. And it also changes the whole, it means that in the end, you're probably looking for representations of another algebra. So it's maybe not so important to solve the first problem. Finally, one would like to take these the results from cylindrical general relativity, cylindrical symmetric general relativity, back to full symmetry-less general relativity. Okay, that is actually not. It's not difficult to put the delta function back, okay? But the main difficulty, although it doesn't seem insurmountable, is that you're assuming a very special type of caustic at the end of the generators, that the generators meet basically that the end of this null hypersurface, all the generators meet just uniformly contracting together, like in the vertex of a light cone. Okay, and that's of course not generically the case, so you have to get rid of that assumption in the formalism. With this is, yeah. Okay, so that's it.
Okay. Any further questions?
If you were doing full JR, wouldn't you go back to regularity?
No,
but you want to get rid of this
caustic. Well, but you could.
What's just a caustic? Is it just a caustic? I mean, space time regular. Wouldn't you want the space time to be regular at the thing that just replaces the symmetry axis?
I suppose so.
Yeah, I suppose that would be nice. Yeah, it would be the most natural assumption. Although it would be nice not to impose anything.
Not to impose
any condition. You could have your.
But you're not allowing singularities elsewhere.
Sure. Right. So you could
say, well, I want to limit myself to hypersurfaces, initial data hypersurfaces that live entirely in a regular part of, at least in classical theory of space-time. But you could also say, well, you could be more ambitious and say, well, you want them to, you want to allow them to go right up to a singularity also. It's also possible. But if that gives trouble, then of course you retreat to the more conservative assumption.
Even if you don't have the representation, that's known about the Jungian representation. So in your case, can you tell whether it will be finite dimensional or infinite dimensional?
Well, I think the finite dimensional of this original thing we've studied, I don't think those representations will ultimately be relevant. I want the representations of an algebra that also includes the data lambda and rho.
Okay, this is a subalgebra.
No, I'm not sure it's a subalgebra.
It's a sub-Poisson algebra.
It's a sub-Poisson algebra, but I don't know if that once you quantize it, you get the quantized algebra will be the quantized algebra of the M's will be a sub with this included will be a subalgebra of the others.
It closes. It's a subalgebra.
No, but that's true. But
so, you know, you have a subalgebra, you have a bigger opposition, the bigger algebra, you have the opposition of the subalgebra.
Yeah, M with M closes.
But M has a non-trivial bracket with lambda.
Yeah,
but
that's something
else. I know.
It doesn't change that you have to represent that subalgebra.
Yeah, classically, there's no doubt it would be subalgebra.
It's a subalgebra.
Yeah, but it may be that the sub representation theorem, you don't need the sub representation theorem subalgebra. It depends what kind of subalgebra is. Like if you think of the primary algebra, the Lorentz group is a sub. Pythagorean group. Let's say the Lorentz group is a subgroup of it, but when you look at representations of the Poincaré group, you don't end up solving representations of the Lorentz group.
But you do. It's not unitary.
I mean, you get in the end. You get some a non-unitary.
But
the problem of
what you're talking is unitarity. But if you have a big algebra, you're talking about unitarity.
No, I'm not talking about it.
If you have a big algebra and you represent the big algebra, you represent the
Absolutely, yeah. Of course, that's true. But I'm just saying that the problem, if your aim is to classify the representation of the big algebra, you're not required to classify the representation of the subalgebra just because it's a representation.
No, you're not talking about classification. You're just talking, you're going to have.
Find a representation.
It doesn't have to be unitary.
I'm not sure that.
But
I mean, there's a.
It's a star algebra. The
Poisson algebra, which has a sub algebra. Then there's a quantum algebra, which should reduce to this Poisson algebra in a sense,
and a limit. But it's not clear to me that there will be in this quantum algebra subalgebra, which will be the same as the quantization of the original subalgebra. I mean, I'm not sure. Maybe it is this way, but maybe not. So in particular, in this case, I'm interested in finite dimensional representations because in the end, I want to see if the holographic hypothesis is verified or at least can be imposed in this case in the following form that I say, let's consider the subspace, consider the eigen subspace of the Hilbert space corresponding to some eigenvalue of the area of S0. And the holographic principle would claim then, would give a bound on the dimensionality of this subspace. Because you're saying that the area of S0 is a certain value, and at least Bousso's version extrapolated to of the holographic principle extrapolated to pure gravity, which is not what he dealt with, but it's extrapolated, then would say that the Hilbert space of states of the field, once the area of S0 is fixed, should be have this certain finite dimension, which is exponential of area, so or 4 in Planck units. Okay, so then, if that is to be the case, I would certainly be interested in in finite dimensional representations. So that's what I can answer to that.
But this is for one point, so you still have an infinite number of points.
One point.
One theta. So even if this representation is finite dimensional, you're still going to have an infinite tensor product of finite dimensional representation, which is ill-defined.
Yeah, but I have sort of a picture in my head of how this could come out.
Well, maybe I'm wondering.
Non-commutativity across theta.
Yeah, so I think I have this idea that in the full theory, you'll have S0 will have some points which sort of like a two-dimensional loop quantization with some points which have a finite area and everything else is sort of ungeometry, no distance. And you'd have associated with each of these points a finite dimensional Hilbert space, which is a representation of the, which carries a representation of this algebra of the rest of the gravitational data.
Do you see that coming out? Because
I have to do this and then look for the representation.
So suppose it's finite dimensional. Okay. You know, when you put the sphere together, you're going to take an infinite tensor product.
Why infinite?
Because any tensor.
I mean, that's like in loop quantization, you don't have an infinite tensor product.
Yeah, but in your case, you don't see non-commutativity across different theta.
I don't know. I mean, it's easy enough to just make a quantization of the algebra of lambda and rho in the loop style, and it comes out that you have these little points that have, you know, Planck area each one, and or n times Planck area, and the total area is the sum of that.
I'm not talking about lambda and rho. I'm talking about the theta dependence.
I don't know. I think it's for me at least, it's pretty hard to see that far ahead.
Okay. So, no, I was just going to have to find Laurent's time for making it. Okay.
Okay, well, so maybe we have to buy it.
I had a separate question for the
discussion. I mean, let's read the rest of the